Yeah, that's a really powerful question.
That's a beautiful question.
That's a very wise question, Lauren.
Hello, and welcome to The Right Question, a radio program and podcast featuring authors from the American West and beyond. The Right Question is supported in part by Humanities Montana and members of Montana Public Radio, and by the Greater Montana Foundation, encouraging communication on issues, trends, and values of importance to Montanans. I'm Lauren Korn, speaking with poet, essayist, and cultural critic Hanif Abdurraqib, author of There's Always This Year, On Basketball and Ascension, a book as much about home, what it means to be from and honored by a place, as it is about the subjects of its title, basketball, longing, and success. There's Always This Year is structured into the quarters and countdown clocks of a basketball game and reckons with grief and devotion, time and aging, and Hanif's very specific and moving philosophies of witness. Hanif, thank you so much for joining me once again. Welcome back to The Right Question.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me again.
I'm going to start off with what on its face is kind of a simple question, but it might be difficult given the limited time we have. For those of us who have never been, introduce us to Columbus, Ohio.
Columbus through my lens, I think, is a vibrant place of art makers and people who are, at least in my corner of it, trying to archive a city that is rapidly vanishing and being swallowed through gentrification. But it's a vibrant community of artists, of writers, of thinkers, and of people who are, I think, visionaries and happy to be in community with each other and thankful to be, in a space where they can look to the side of themselves and see people creating in unison with them.
I want to stick with this idea of creation or creating. So much of your work orbits music, or maybe music orbits so much of your work. And I wanted to combine this book's place or home-leaning aboutness, that is East Columbus, to, if not the music mentioned within the book, at least to music more generally. I'm curious, Hanif, what does East Columbus sound like? What song or which musician elicits what you call in the book a feeling of there for you?
Well, I don't know. I mean, I don't know if I can speak broadly for the entirety of East Columbus, but I think in my house, in my neighborhood, there was a lot of R&B and a lot of 90s hip hop that really calls me back to the corners that I grew up on and the time I spent, especially recording mixtapes off the radio. Like, that's such a memorable experience for me and such a vibrant and beautiful experience for me. And so I think that to me, East Columbus is a series of sounds of old radio DJs and taking cassette tapes out of the packaging and these kind of things, but really, you know, stitching together a soundtrack of a place is hard because there are also several parts of the machinery of East Columbus that aren't what they were, but the things that always call me back are, you know, hearing a car driving by with a loud stereo. And sometimes, you know, when cars drive by with loud stereos, as they get further away, the sound kind of begins to warp and bend a bit. That fascinated me so much as a child, what happens to sound as it gets further away from us. And that is something that calls me back. Of course, that happens in many places, but that very much calls me back to East Columbus.
Hanif, you write about the emotional infrastructure of a place in a section of the book titled First Quarter, City as Its True Self. It occurred to me after coming across that particular phrase that basketball, or whatever cultural material you're tethering your personal experiences to, whether that's A Tribe Called Quest or Black Performance, these topics are the emotional foundation for numerous other subjects, other topics. In this book, aging or grief, home, place, success. I'm wondering, Hanif, how or why you decided on basketball, on LeBron James, on other players coming up in Ohio during your childhood as the foundation for the experiences that you've braided into this book, and specifically, why now?
Well, I mean, I think that basketball to me was an easy thing to approach because I was really asking questions of the passage of time and aging and what it means to watch a clock descend. And I think LeBron James is someone who people, you know, have projected a kind of immortality upon, which is not real. Of course, we know that and we understand that, but it has been projected upon him nonetheless. And so I got very interested in writing a book or telling a story about the foolishness of believing one might live forever and kind of contrasting that with the version of my life where I did not want to live much at all. And, you know, basketball's the kind of container for this book, but also when I was growing up, I loved fantasy books and I loved the writer Lloyd Alexander. And in one of his books, he writes about a river or a lake. It's a lake, I believe, where the person who goes to the lake looks in and what's reflected back to them is what they most desire. The reflection in the water shows them what they most want to see. And I was really moved and inspired by that when writing this book. I wanted to write a book where, you know, people could kind of walk to it and look into it and whatever they wanted to see would be reflected back to them. If they wanted a book about grief and loss, they could find that. If they wanted a book about fatherhood and parenthood, they could find that. If they wanted kind of like a straightforward basketball book, certainly they could find that in here. But my approach was never, I want to make a clear, straightforward basketball book. It was, how can I use basketball to answer some greater questions that I am wrestling with?
And I imagine, just like poetry, you're trying to elicit certain feelings from your readers as well, right? Does that resonate with you?
Well, for sure. Yeah. I mean, I think that this is maybe my most poetic book, even more so than my actual books of poetry in some ways. And I think it's because I felt myself really wrestling with several things, trying to connect several threads and several ideas, not just through the course of the quarters or the sections or chapters or whatever one wants to call them in a traditional sense, but throughout the entirety of the book, like throughout the actual entirety of the book's machinery, I am trying and I hope succeeding to thread together several large ideas. And the only way I know how to build those bridges is through poetic device and through the beauty of language that poetry affords me.
This book's title, There's Always This Year, is a play on the adage, usually in sports, regarding a team's loss, there's always next year. And this book, as we've been talking about, is so much about the passage of time. I'm curious, Hanif, how you approached language in, or subsequently to, this book, Guided by Time, in the way that you've presented it here, that may differ from the way that you previously approached language, or that you might be tempted to approach language outside of the project of this book.
Yeah, I mean, I think one thing that's notable about this book is the urgency with which I approached it. You know, it is a heavily experimental book with a lot of risk, I think, and a lot of attempts at innovation from my past work, which to me was challenging because I'm distinctly aware of the fact that I could just write, you know, a kind of, I could write They Can't Kill Us Until They Kill Us over and over and over again. And I think people would be fine with that. You know, I think people would at least not be angry at that. You know, I think that for me in the moment, I was asking myself, how can I be better? How can I be different? How can I ask more of myself as a person who is invested in evolution? And how can I also not put off these kind of attempts at innovation and urgency until the next book? You know, I think it is so easy for me to say, I'll try that next time or I'll get that next time out. But to present a real urgency and say, well, there's no guarantee that I'll write another book again, that I'll even want to write another book again. And so the things that I'm dreaming have to be, they have to take place now. It is almost a requirement that they take place now. And that also fed into the book's title, where it's kind of like it's now or it might not be ever. And so with that in mind, what kind of work can be done?
You write in the book, Hanif, that, quote, what is real and what is not real is sometimes simply a matter of who is witnessing the miracle and who can be tricked into a suspension of disbelief at the altar of light. This book is so much, among a number of things, about bearing witness. And tell me, Hanif, if I'm way off base here, but you seem to be proving that the privilege of witness sort of eradicates certain boundaries of understanding. In this passage, real or not real, ideas of goodness or evil. I mean, you begin the book sort of blurring the line between one's enemies and one's beloveds, that to witness, to observe, is an act of love that sort of blurs binaries. Can you speak to the intentionality of witness, Hanif, or even to the responsibilities of witness that you sought to explore in this book?
Yeah, well, for me, the central work of witness as it manifests itself in this book was saying, I am from a place and there are people from that place. I'm from a place that does not get spoken about in a way that honors the people here. And as it related to the specific basketball players that came up watching, it was for me a real thing of, I came up watching, like a lot of people who grew up around basketball and basketball players, there are players in the city where I came from who mean so much to this place and who made it. Yeah, this book is also complicating what it is to make it. Yes, there are guys who did not, quote unquote, make it out of, you know, out of East Columbus to go to the NBA, but their names are so beloved and revered on the streets here, that is a form of making it. And so, and I get to say, I saw that. I saw a thing that you did not see. You know, when I was young, my first bit of writing, my first forays into writing were writing in zines, punk zines, because everyone wanted a zine in the era I came up in, early 2000s, early mid 2000s, but no one really wanted to write in them. And it seemed to me that to write, you know, regionally or regional, local zines, it seemed to me that to write in these zines was to report from the place I was that not everyone could be, and to tell the good story of where, to what I've seen and what I'd witnessed. And, you know, I just believe in the evangelical approach, which is largely saying my responsibility, I don't know if I want to call it even a responsibility, but the thing that draws me to this work is that we can all collectively watch something and see it differently. We can all collectively live in a place and view that place differently. We can all collectively watch the crumbling of the world we are sharing and feel different urgencies around that. And so adding my voice to the chorus of witness perhaps feels like enough responsibility, but also doing something with that and not treating witness as a stagnant approach also feels urgent.
I'm wondering if your status as a public figure, whether in your hometown of Columbus or nationally, has changed or altered your philosophies of witness and community building.
I don't know if my philosophy has, but there are limitations now, because I do feel like I am someone who is more broadly witnessed. I'm more often the subject of the witnessing of others, which means that it is in some ways harder to build organic community, it requires more work or a slightly different approach to maintain or build organic community when you are kind of a subject of witness in a way. But I will say that it also, I think, makes me feel more urgent around the responsibility I have as a person in a community, as an organizer, or as someone who is very invested in, you know, I'm so invested in friendship, prolonged friendship. I know it does get harder as we age. It does get harder to make friends in some organic ways, but I don't want to surrender the desire I have to meet people, to really find people who might connect with me. The thing that I mourn, a thing that I mourn often, is the knowledge that there are people in the world, perhaps several people in the world, who would love me well and I'll never meet them. I mean, that's the case for all of us, right? There are several people in the world who might love us extremely well, and we'll never come across those people. And what's even more, like, those people genuinely have no idea we exist and could not be any less interested in the fact that of our existence. And that's a real point of grieving. But what it also says for me is that I cannot take community building lightly in the present sense. I have to be really present and urgent about my desire for community building now, because there are people touchable and closer to me who might change my life, and I want to be present for that. And so I think I don't know if that's changed. Honestly, I don't know if that has much to do with my the degree to which I'm a public figure. I think it actually has more to do with my aging. Hmm. Honestly, I think it has more to do with kind of getting older and not necessarily wanting to give up on the reality of interpersonal contact. Now I do, yeah, but I am aware. I'm very aware that being in some ways a public figure, I guess, which is strange. I don't know if any writer should be a public figure, you know? But, you know, in that sense, I am aware that it does make community building somewhat more challenging.
You're listening to A Conversation with Hanif Abdurraqib. I'm Lauren Korn. This episode of The Right Question is supported by Chapter One Bookstore in Hamilton, Montana, a literary and community resource for the Bitterroot Valley, providing space to explore, discover, and share passions since 1974. More information can be found at chapteronebookstore.com. Hanif, I'm curious about whether this book, whether the writing, the publishing, or the touring of this book changed the way you consider aging. And maybe my question is specifically your aging. Did it change those ideas for you?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I think especially working on the book, not even so much, but truly working on the book grounded me in a kind of satisfaction and comfort around aging. Not that I was ever, I don't know that I was ever uncomfortable with it, but I had anxieties. I mean, I think that many of us do. You know, not just aesthetic anxieties, but anxieties more for me about losing time. And to confront myself with a book project where I was staring a countdown clock in the face, very literally, and crafting a book around that, the nature of that countdown clock, I did find myself with a real sense of comfort. You know, in kind of gratitude for the time that I had. And also a kind of, again, a kind of urgency around, I'll say, I mean, one thing that really was impactful for me is that I'm just like becoming my father. There are so many ways that I'm becoming my father, you know, and my father and I have not always had a very easy relationship. We've had a somewhat complicated relationship at times. And it was so great for me to make peace with that, make peace with that becoming while working on this book, and to say the task that is in front of me now is to have grace, learn to have grace for the versions of myself that are becoming my father, which is learning to have grace for the times where my father and I had a more difficult stretch, because to have grace for him and me and that is just to have grace for the future versions of myself to come. And I think I require that. Like, I actually require that in order to, you know, live well, I think. I require that. And so that was the realest, that was like the biggest revelation with aging, I think, for me.
You toss the words, and I guess I should not use the word toss. That sort of presumes a flippancy that I know is not the case. I know that you take great care in choosing your words, but you use the words fool and foolish a great deal in this book. And I don't want to believe that you've done so in these many acts of self-deprecation, but instead are really writing about culpability and transparency, particularly in the book's last quarter. Is that a fair reading, Hanif, or is there something else to be said here about that vulnerability?
Oh, yeah. So much of the approach is, for me, trying to be even if somewhat playfully, trying to be accountable for a place I've led someone to, and say, isn't it a little foolish that we have arrived here knowing what we know of the world, and I've led us here, and isn't that foolish? But, you know, there's always kind of, but since we're here, and since we know what we know, how can we survive better? But it is acknowledging. I mean, it's acknowledging the realities of, I've taken us to a place, and that place is not always essentially beneficial to everyone, but we're here nonetheless. And a lot of it is also because I am saying, I've led us to a place and I did not know we would end up here, you know, and we have nonetheless. And so, you know, it's really just an acknowledgement of where I've taken us and how I'm not someone who really thinks that I am required to have answers. I don't really need answers. And that, I think, makes writing more fulfilling for me to say, we might end up somewhere that feels wrong, but we're going to be there. We're going to get there no matter what. And so if we are going to get there, what questions can we ask of this place I led you to, understanding that, yes, it might have been a little foolish.
I'm glad we're talking about leading your readers to this place, Hanif, because I want to talk about where you've led your readers at the end of this book. Throughout the book, there are a number of what I'll call poetic interludes. You've titled them Timeouts in Praise of Legendary Ohio Aviators. And until we reach the end of the book, aviators is pretty literal. You're writing about those who have taken literal flight, pilots or astronauts. But we reach the end of the book, and where there was once, or in many points in the book, timeouts, there is now a brief post-game scouting report, again, in praise of legendary Ohio aviators. And here you've written about LeBron James and about yourself. So tell me, Hanif, about that decision or that impulse to bring yourselves together in this moment in the way that you have.
Yeah, I mean, I wanted to play with, you know, there are a couple of folks who are maybe not aviators in the literal sense, and that, you know, Morrison and
sure,
but
sure
to think about like the taking a flight as a kind of, I really wanted to craft the book with an understanding of ascension as not just something that takes us upward, but something that moves anyone from a place they were to a place they dream themselves of being. And, you know, it felt really urgent to me to end the book with a small analysis of someone who, for much of my life witnessing them in LeBron, felt like they were always ascending and there was no other option, to someone like myself. And writing that about myself was challenging, really challenging, to someone who has ended up somewhere that I did not dream, in some stage of my life did not want to be. You know, I didn't really envision myself living beyond 25. And I think to write in this way is to kind of attempt to forgive that past version of myself who did not want to be here. And say, okay, I've gotten over to that other threshold, and what can I make of it now that I'm here?
Yeah, hearing you talk about those moments in your life where you didn't want to be here, you do talk or you do write towards those moments in the book, but you also, Hanif, write in many moments, in many instances, particularly in your childhood or early adulthood, about or toward survival. You are running from the cops. You are trying to find a meal. You are trying to find a place to sleep at night after you are evicted from your apartment. So while there are these moments of not wanting to be here, as you've just been talking about, there is in you an impulse to survive.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, those two things were fighting against each other for a lot of my 20s. I think, you know, those two impulses where I found myself deeply dissatisfied and unhappy. And at the same time, I found myself wanting to see what was next, curious if the what next could be better than the what is, or, you know, mm-hmm. What is and what's next. I think there's a, sometimes a gap between those two. And I find myself still so eager about what could be next. I think that's just the thing that dominates my brain always, is a kind of eagerness around that question of what could possibly be the next thing. And that, you know, I feel like that keeps my wheel spinning, because the next thing could be worse than this, but it could be better. There's, you know, that's unexpected nature, is really thrilling to me. And I'm trying to, I think, just build upon the possibilities of what's next.
I want to linger on what you just said, Hanif, about there being a gap between what is and what is next. I'm reminded of a line in the book wherein you write, "There is a mountain between the immediacy of anguish and the far-off hopefulness of clarity." And I'm also reminded of another line in what we were talking about, these brief post-game scouting reports. You write about yourself that the kid has seen every apocalypse before it arrives. And I think the question that lives for me is somewhere between those lines, or even outside of those lines in our current moment. Is there ultimately hope in apocalypse?
Yeah, I mean, I'm of the belief that the world has ended many times over, which is a kind of a pulled from the brilliant poet Franny Choi's conceptualization of apocalypse. And the world will continue to end. And it actually does not require us. Because I don't know if apocalypse necessarily even means the end of an existence for us as people. It just means that the world as we know it is ending and will continue to end. You know, several intersecting apocalypses are happening at once and will continue to happen. And if I am alive through them, I get to ask myself the question of how I would like to live through them. So I think, you know, the real sense of hope I have is that I get to ask myself repeatedly what kind of apocalypse I would like to have and then chase after it.
With that, Hanif, thank you so much for indulging me in this conversation. Thank you so much for being here.
No, thank you. It was so good to talk to you again, and hope to see you when I'm out there.
That was Hanif Abdurraqib, a poet, essayist, and cultural critic from Columbus, Ohio, and the recipient of a MacArthur Foundation Genius Grant. In addition to There's Always This Year on Basketball and Dissension, out now from Penguin Random House, Hanif is the author of A Little Devil in America, In Praise of Black Performance, They Can't Kill Us Until They Kill Us, Go Ahead in the Rain, Notes to a Tribe Called Quest, and two books of poetry. He is a graduate of Beechcroft High School. Look for more information about Hanif at mtpr.org, where you can also listen to a new segment called The Cover Story, in which I ask my guests about the stories and the processes behind their book covers. You've been listening to The Right Question. This episode was produced by Chris Moyles and me. I'm your host, Lauren Korn. Chris also engineered this episode. The artwork for The Right Question was designed by Molly Russell. Funding for The Right Question is provided by the Greater Montana Foundation, encouraging communication on issues, trends, and values of importance to Montanans. Many thanks to Humanities Montana for supporting this program since 2008, and thank you for listening. The Right Question is a production of Montana Public Radio.